This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Later in the show, we have a comics roundtable with the Idiot Box, the mother-daughter musical team of Pamela and Andrea Howland, and the innovative mobile designs of Jay Jones. But first, we step into the absolute elsewhere. The music of Crystal Bright and the Silver Hands is not easily pigeonholed. From gypsy jazz to klezmer rave-ups to Danny Elfman-esque gothic soundscapes, the music forges a dark yet whimsical path. Led by vocalist and multi-instrumentalist Crystal Bright, a 12-piece version of the band is playing a CD release concert Saturday night in Carrboro. She spoke with me about her new photograph-inspired album, The Absolute Elsewhere.
Inside my head, it seems to me.
Well, congratulations on the new record, The Absolute Elsewhere.
Thank you.
It's very awesome. How long has that been in the making?
It has been about a year and a half now since I started the whole process with Rusty and Jim.
Okay, and that's Rusty McDonald?
Yes.
So who is that?
He is the photographer whose pictures that I've written all the songs to on this album.
So the photos already existed before you wrote the songs, or you worked in conjunction?
Most of them already existed, and he actually did two of them to my songs. So it was kind of a cyclical thing.
Oh, okay.
Most of them were already existing, and I brought out the stories and the emotions and the characters in the photo.
Since they do correspond to the visuals, how does that unfold as far as the release, and so people can see the visuals, or is that part of the CD, or?
Well, yeah, there's different layers to it. So okay. The CD is going to have a booklet, a 16-page booklet, with all of the photos with the lyrics beside them. And at the CD release show, we'll have the projections of the photos behind us while we're playing that song that it goes with. Rusty will be there at the show, and he'll have prints of all the photos and his other work as well.
Have you ever done that sort of thing before, directly writing to the image? I know as songwriters, sometimes you have an image in mind, or something strikes you and you write a song, but that kind of direct approach, is this your first time you've had that kind of experience?
It is, actually. With writing for images, it is the first time. And so it was an interesting writing process for me because a lot of the subject matter I didn't really know much about, like Sherlock Holmes or certain pagan rituals. And so I had to do a lot of research, and that's how I came up with the lyrics, was getting words and phrases from my research and then kind of making a story with it.
And I was going to ask you, how do you think the results were different compared to before?
Well, it's more direct this way. It's more focused. So I think this album is a lot more focused and mature because the subject matter is definitely about one thing per song, and it's not kind of really esoteric because
it's almost like having an assignment more so than plumbing the inner depths.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And, but you still know, you are, I mean, because you're still having to come up with the...
Right, yeah. It is still a channeling process for writing the lyrics and the story, making it all come together.
So what instruments do you play?
Well, my first instrument is piano. The second instrument I picked up was guitar in middle school because it was cool and I wanted to be cool too. I don't really play guitar that much anymore. I like to sometimes, but I played vihuela, which is a small guitar in the mariachi band. That's when I also started playing accordion. So accordion is kind of my second instrument. And then I also play musical saw, which is really fun, and the adungu, which is a Ugandan harp. And various percussion things and smaller things, whatever I can get my hands on.
And how have you picked up some of these, like the Ugandan instrument? How do you come across that?
Well, that was one of the ensembles that I played at Florida State while I was studying ethnomusicology. So it came from my Ugandan teacher from Uganda.
Okay. And then, so you studied ethnomusicology, you got out of school, and then what did you do after that?
I actually went to Montana for 6 months.
That's what you do.
Live in the woods.
Oh, okay.
I always wanted to see what Montana was like, and it was impeccable timing. It was like a calling that was on my list of places to possibly live, even though I'd never been there. And I got this letter in the mail randomly from Montana Conservation Corps saying, hey, come work for Montana Conservation Corps, working on maintaining trails and noxious weed mapping and weatherizing low-income homes and stuff. So I did that for 6 months, and it was one of the hardest times of my life. Getting up when it's dark and zero-degree weather. I smashed my finger between a rock and a cliffside once and was bleeding a lot and thought I broke my finger, but I didn't. And
so you left that terrible experience, and then you came back to...
Yeah, I came back to Greensboro to live in an anarchist collective house. We had weekly meals together and took turns cooking, and everybody did chores, and they had Food Not Bombs there frequently. So that was an interesting time in my life. Mm-hmm. And then I moved out and lived in an apartment by myself and started working at the Montessori school.
You taught music there?
I did, yes. Music and dance with a world music kind of angle.
So during that time, had you begun writing the songs for what would become, you know, Silver Hand songs?
No, actually, that didn't happen until after I got laid off. I was in a band during that time with a couple guys. And then I got laid off, broke up with my boyfriend, and lost the band all in 1 month. So completely started over, which was really scary. But thankfully, I was on unemployment for a little bit, so I was like, hey, now's the perfect time to start writing my own music. Listen to the earth again. Harmony is forgotten. I will be with you until the end.
So the album opens up with a song called The End, which is pretty funny. The end is at the beginning. So what is that about?
That one is about Sherlock Holmes, actually, and the idea of what we love about Sherlock Holmes and how everything isn't what it seems to be. And it's a cool photo that Rusty did with this Sherlock Holmes character in it with his back facing the camera. So I didn't really know much about Sherlock Holmes before, so I had to do a lot of research. And I also started watching the BBC show. You know, now I'm hooked because it's really good.
Because it's great.
Yeah. There's a line in there saying, you'll be the end of me. I kind of brought, I guess, his kind of love life into that, where he's such a sociopath and can't really be with anyone truly. So it's kind of from the perspective of maybe somebody that would be trying to be involved with him. There's a theme throughout the CD of the end being the beginning and the cyclical process of everything. There's a song, Earth Above My Roots, where one of the lines says, the end is the beginning. And then the last song called Choke is a very loud, raucous, it's pretty metal for this album, actually. It's the metal song in the end. And it just gets crazy, and it's about the earth reclaiming herself and kind of a new beginning.
With that idea and the cyclical nature of everything and Earth reclaiming herself, this is a theme that goes throughout some of your songs.
Yes.
You have lines about twisted branches and seed and root and clove and orange peel and all this. So I'd like to know more about how you connect your view of the Earth and maybe ecology and how it ties in to your music.
There's this whole landscape that Rusty has created called The Absolute Elsewhere. That's where the title of the album came from. It was this whole land that he created, and he created the landscapes, he drew the landscapes, and he created all the characters, and they are intertwined and they live in this place. And it's kind of another dimension, and time is off, it's not quite right, and they're kind of stuck in these constant stories. They're stuck in their story. And there's a lot of themes of pagan rituals going throughout, which are very nature-based. And there's some songs that involve the earth coming back to itself and just the greediness and the messiness of human nature that is destructive, that makes me sad. But it wasn't an obvious thing in Rusty's works. It was just something that I brought out because it's something that I'm really interested in and that is always in the forefront of my mind.
When I was watching the video of your Indiegogo campaign that you had for this record, you had a video, I guess, about midway through the process where you were showing some different instruments in the studio, and there were some unique instruments used on this record. Could you describe a couple of those? I know there was one that was built, and it was like this steampunk stick of some sort.
Yeah,
that was
it is a steampunk stick.
I don't know if you could you describe that over radio to make sense?
It's pretty much a stump fiddle, which is affiliated with polka music and bluegrass. You don't see them very often, but I came across a video and I was like, Brad, the guy that I live with, let's build one of these. So he and his wife and I went to the junk store and went around banging on all kinds of stuff with sticks to see what kind of tone it had, and then designed it and he put it together for me, and it's really fun.
So you were going around banging on things and you knew there was like a certain timbre you were looking for?
Like a pitch, okay. Like a nice pitch, because it's made out of a candle snuffer, some coal pans, and like an ashtray, and a brass lid for something, and some tin pans, and a baking pan, and stuff like that. And so you bounce it up and down, and it has corn inside of the pan, and there's a long wire, a thick wire that goes from the top to the bottom, and you bounce it and hit it with the stick.
Did that find its way onto a lot of songs, or?
I think maybe only one or two, yeah.
Were there any other like neat instruments that maybe people hadn't heard of that you used on the record?
I used a toaster oven rack and a pan. I don't know how that came about, but there was stuff laying around in the studio, and I was like, ooh, and I just lifted up the toaster oven rack and threw it in the pan, and it had this really cool sound. And then we used that in one of the songs, Earth Above My Roots, and then did it in reverse, too, and it's about spiders. And so it's like, it has this little crazy spider sounding when we put it in reverse.
Walking through the garden, tasting all the flowers, smelling.
Where did you record the record?
On Pop of the World Studios with Randy Seals in Greensboro.
Okay, yeah. Cool. It sounds great. But the dynamic range on the record is really, really good. It's really getting from a quiet, loud, like extremes, and all kind of makes sense. And
that's cool. That was one of the things that I was definitely going for. Like, I really wanted this to be a dynamic record because there's so many different emotions.
So there's an instrumental song on the record, Tree of Tantalus, which leads into Torment and Choke. And I feel like that was to serve as a bridge to these two pretty dark songs on the record. Why did you want to have an epilogue?
The Tree of Tantalus picture is just this beautiful print of a tree that Rusty created. And so when I was talking to him about the story of the tree, we were trying to figure out, is there somebody buried beneath it? It's a sad, melancholy, still whimsical feeling that you get looking at the picture, and I tried to bring that out with the music. So it was just piano and strings, and I wrote the string parts myself, which was really cool to give to the string players and hear that come to life, because I've never done that before. The next one, Torment, we decided that she was related to the tree, that maybe she was mourning something that had to do with the tree. So those two things are connected in the Absolute Elsewhere land. And so the tree was a nice flow into Torment, which is a really intense picture with her hands over her face, and it makes you want to cry. Like, while I was writing the song, looking at the picture, I was crying, and I just thought, what's going on with her? So I had to create this thing that was going on with her, so I just came up with all these self-defeating thoughts that we tell ourselves that totally hold ourselves back, you know, and that's pretty much what the song is, these self-defeating thoughts that can get you down. But while I was going through it, it was a kind of a healing process where I could realize that, yes, I have these emotions and these feelings too, and so do a lot of people, but if you work through them and you can feel them and work through it, then you can rise above it. So there's a lot of that going throughout the album and my songs as well, overcoming self-oppression, which is really hard thing for me and I'm sure a lot of other artists, because we can get so much love and support from people for what we give, the music and the art that we give, but there's still a lot of insecurity there.
Well, Crystal Bright, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
Crystal Bright. You can catch her and a 12-piece band this Saturday at the Carrboro Arts Center. The occasion is the release of The Absolute Elsewhere, the new CD that was inspired by 13 photographs from Rusty McDonald of Dividing Me Photography. If you can't make the trip to Carrboro this weekend, Crystal will be playing at the Garage in Winston-Salem in January of the new year. Visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend for more info on the concert, the photos, and the music of Crystal Bright and the Silver Hands. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend on 88.5 WFDD. I'm Eddie Garcia. Next up, Bethany Chafin brings us an interview with a mother-daughter musical duo.
Musical talent and appreciation run deep with our next duo. Pamela Howland is an acclaimed American pianist and Steinway artist. She's toured the country, performed live on National Public Radio, and for ambassadors overseas. She's known for educating audience members with her informative, imaginative, and entertaining performances. Pamela's daughter, Andrea, is a celebrated soprano. She took first place at the 2013 Hefner Williams Vocal Competition in Lincolnton, North Carolina. She's appeared in operas such as Little Women and Il Campanello, among others. Andrea currently resides in Durham and works with North Carolina Opera. Pamela and Andrea are bringing their talent and imagination to Parkway United Church of Christ this Sunday with their program, Songs Our Mothers Taught Us. The concert is the first in Parkway UCC's series, Music That Matters. Pamela and Andrea will perform the music of their heritage, works by Polish, French, and American composers. The duo joined me in the studio at WFDD to talk about their recent travels and collaborating musically with one another. So this performance is titled Songs Our Mothers Taught Us. So Andrea, let me ask you, what were some of the first songs that your mother taught you?
Oh gosh.
Do you remember?
That's a really good question. Probably nursery rhymes. There's one, Mary Wore a Red Dress, that I remember from very early on. And I remember we did a lot of singing around the house when my sister and I were little, and a lot of, you know, nursery rhymes, a lot of songs from Disney movies. And I think Mom made up a lot of songs about just sort of childhood routine things like eating your breakfast or brushing your teeth or things like that.
But we did do a lot of singing around the house. We used to listen to, you know, orchestral performances, and we had a series of bells and tambourines and, you know, we kind of made our own Kinder music. I grew up much the same way. I did start formal piano at 6. But I have 2 sisters, and my family was kind of poor. We didn't have lots of toys, but we had both classical music and a lot of, you know, Peer Gynt Suite, Debussy, orchestral work. So we would ride the rocking horses, and, you know, we had a lot of pretend games. So we had a lot of singing also. And then, of course, instrumental lessons. I've always felt that one of the things that does distinguish me from the millions of other, you know, phenomenal pianists out there with classical training is that I did grow up with everything, because my mom was a swing band pianist, amateur pianist in the 1940s. So we had boogie-woogie and then, of course, you know, lots of different genres of music. But the classical sort of has been the enduring one.
Yeah. Well, did she share many stories about that time of playing with that swing band with you?
Not a lot. And I think that, you know, she's been gone 8 years now, but in looking back and finding some photos of this all-girl band, and they've got their frocks on, and some of them are horn players, and there's a drummer, and here's my mom at the piano. And I have one really charming photo of my mom and then her dad, who's my grandpa, who came here from Poland. So he was emceeing this concert, and he sang, and he was in a mandolin club. So the picture kind of tells the story. I think, like so many people from that time, they had really mixed feelings about World War II, so they didn't talk about it a lot. I think it was great fun. She adored it, but it also was for a group of people who were very, very young. She graduated from high school at 18 in 1945, and a lot of her classmates died in the war. So I think there was that mixed feeling about it.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I think is really striking to me, thinking back about like our family history and this program that we've put together, which is sort of loosely about our family, is that it's probably not very surprising to anyone that mom, who is like this very highly trained musician, would have incorporated music into raising her children. But she also has, you know, so many stories about how she and her sisters, who were being raised by this amateur pianist, how important music was in their lives, but also Grandpa D, her factory worker grandpa, who had a Polish and German immigrant background. She would sing a couple songs to us when we were children that he would sing to them. And even for him, music was very, very important. So it's not just that we like music and we're thinking about our family, so we decided to put them together, but like all the way back in our family, people have been looking at things through the prism of music and experiencing things that way.
Mm-hmm. So. You all have been traveling, and you had, was it a trip last year, last December, to Poland, where you performed for the ambassador to Poland?
We did, and we had the great honor of giving a Christmas concert in the American Embassy residence, which is very beautiful.
I bet.
And that was the first time we had formally, I mean, we've been playing together for years.
We have this history of her accompanying me that goes back very far, but this is the first program that we've put together really as musical collaborators, rather than her accompanying me or stepping in to play a recital for me or giving me, you know, some coaching and some feedback. This is the first time that we've really both brought creative ideas to the table and chosen music that was equally rewarding for both of us. And then that was the first time that we got to present that program. So
yes, and I think the biggest difference also is that it's on a very professional level, and we're not fighting anymore. But it's just wonderful. And then we had the great pleasure about a month ago to go back to Poland, and we got to go to several different places, namely Gdańsk, which is way up on the Baltic coast.
Mm. You did some research, some genealogical research while you were there. Did anything that you discovered affect the way you translated or interpreted some of the music you were playing?
One of the things that keeps happening to me on these successive trips to Poland is the shock realization that my grandfather was born 30 miles from Warsaw. You walk down the street in Warsaw, Chopin walked on that street. There's one main thoroughfare. I think a lot more about the fact that all of us, and this is true not just for our family, every family, particularly Americans who have these multi-layered ethnic backgrounds, we are living a life that's based on the backs of all of our ancestors and their hard struggle, their sacrifices. We're here because of that. And when I'm in Poland, it really is kind of spooky and resonates with me.
Andrea, what was that experience like for you?
I've really benefited from the research that she's done and told me about. As a singer, when you have text, you're much more connected to story or specific images, specific ideas that you associate with the music you're working on. And in particular, in this concert, I sing some early Broadway, early American music theater pieces that are about unrequited love and stuff like that. We actually have, for the time period, for about 1905, a pretty scandalous divorce that occurred in our family right after they immigrated here. And as is probably true of most families who even know about what was happening with their ancestors at that time, we have sort of one family legend about it, one perspective on it, and we've been uncovering, you know, sort of the other side of that story. I guess in that situation specifically, and in a lot of different ways, whatever information I can gather that has to do with what their emotional reality probably was, I can find some way to, for that to inspire my interpretation of the songs that I'm singing.
Well, Pam, let me ask you a question. Is there a song that perhaps you grew up hearing, you knew, maybe you played yourself, that then when Andrea performed it or kind of put her her stamp on it, you reinterpreted it or you found something new in it?
Well, you've asked me a great question because there is one song that was sort of my mother's theme song, and that is the piece called Over the Rainbow from The Wizard of Oz. And when my mom died 8 years ago, one of the ways that I tried to deal with this enormous loss was to really play her music. And so for a classically trained musician who was not taught a lot about improvisation, I said, I've got to be more like that. And so I started making a series of arrangements. So I made my own Chopin-inspired arrangement of Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which was wonderful, and people just love it. It's such a beautiful, poignant song. But Andrea is now singing that song. And I'll tell you to not only feel the poignancy of it, just generically, the thing that everybody feels, but to know that that was one of my mom's first pieces of sheet music. I have her 1938 copy with her little name on it. And then to have made my own personal arrangement and then to be accompanying my daughter, it really surely made me cry. And the thing that is great about being a pianist is you can cry and play. It's harder if you get a singer crying, it's pretty tough.
Some words that I've actually heard used to describe you and some of your choices as far as programs go, eclectic and unconventional, or, you know, maybe a little bit unusual based on what people might be expecting. Why is that? And why is that important to you all?
I think that's a great question. And I've given that a lot of thought because I certainly had the same classical training as everybody else. But I just am at the point where I chafe and cannot do the old standard type of show where I just come out, I bow, I play, I leave, I come back out, you know, etc. It's really important to me to make this beautiful music as accessible to everyone as possible. I am one of those people who feels like there's not bad music, there may be just bad performances. So if we're going to do this high art music, Chopin and Debussy, why not have Gershwin along with it? Why not have Harold Arlen's Over the Rainbow, because hopefully we are not only technically doing a great job, but emotionally striking a chord in our listeners' hearts.
Pianist and Steinway artist Pamela Howland and her daughter, soprano Andrea Howland. The duo will be performing their program, Songs Our Mothers Taught Us, this Sunday, November 23rd at Parkway United Church of Christ. The concert begins at 4 p.m. Donations are accepted and proceeds will benefit City With Dwellings, an ecumenical coalition working to end homelessness with opportunities for advocacy and outreach. For more information, visit our website at WFDD.org, and once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Associate Producer Bethany Chafin. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. We need to take a short break, but when we return, it's time to go deep into the minds of a group of comedians and to take a look at the artistic balancing act of Jay Jones when Triad Arts Weekend continues.
Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Triad-based artist Jay Jones began his career 30 years ago in New York as a scenic builder for TV, film, theater, and dance. Along the way, he worked designing and building for Pee-wee's Playhouse, Saturday Night Live, dancer Trisha Brown, and he collaborated with other artists, too, like groundbreaking American painter and graphic artist Robert Rauschenberg. In 1995, Jay moved his woodworking company to Greensboro, and after 12 years engineering and inspecting for City of Greensboro, he started J.F. Jones Mobiles. Jay's handcrafted copper mobiles range from 1 to 8 feet tall, with delicately shaped and polished leaves of dogwood, ginkgo, maple, and oak. The way they reflect the light is really magical, and you'll find them in galleries, shops, and museums like MoMA, the Smithsonian, Guggenheim, and National Gallery of Art, just to name a few of the 150-plus locations worldwide. Jay's latest creation, his mobile kits, made out of different materials, can be assembled by anyone in an infinite variety of ways. All J.F. Jones mobiles are made in the USA, Greensboro, North Carolina, USA, to be exact. The owner, designer, and builder says it all began for him in 2008, following his family's Thanksgiving holiday visit to Washington, D.C., and one fateful trip to the National Gallery of Art, where he chanced upon a 35-foot-wide metal mobile floating gently in the rotunda. It was designed by legendary mobile maker Alexander Calder.
I really didn't need to see anything else in that museum for a long time. I sat there for the longest time. My family walked around for a while, and I just watched it. And then I, of course, found out that there was many other mobiles by Calder in the building.
Were the gears already spinning at that point? You know, how can I make this? Can I pursue this myself?
You know, I was just appreciating the construction element of it, but I don't think I really even registered that, maybe I should give it a try. I don't think I really even did that at that point. But it was later on, I think it might have been the same year, that American Masters had done an expose on Calder. And so my wife bought me for Christmas a DVD of that. I watched that thing until it didn't spin anymore. It was great fun because, you know, you freeze frame, and I can see the construction element of it. I understood the balancing element, that you have to find the focal point, you have all the kind of engineering element, but I wasn't clear on the connectivity between the shapes and, say, the rods. So that's what I really focused in on. And once I got that, then I said, okay, I think I can try this now.
You brought in a couple of your mobiles, one of which is the copper variety and those... Were those ginkgo leaves?
Yes. Yep, that's a ginkgo leaf.
I always loved the shape of those leaves.
It's a wonderful shape. And actually, that shape was inspired by the trees on Elm Street in downtown Greensboro, because there are a whole bunch of ginkgo trees lining Elm Street.
How about that?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And I think I saw it probably in the fall. I stepped around the corner, and suddenly you saw this blaze of gold with the leaves had turned.
Thankfully, you brought these in, because I got a chance to see it in three dimension versus the static image on the computer screen. And I want to know, first off, the process of putting this together, mm-hmm. and then also how what you've learned working the copper over the years, and how you get that great patina on some and leave others shine. And it's a really nice look.
It's a really interesting process, and I'm enjoying building a lot of them, and I have a couple guys that help me in the shop. I equate it not unlike being a painter, in that you have to work for years and years to understand the material and the tools and the techniques. And at this point, I'm feeling much more comfortable after building thousands of them.
This is hand-hammered copper?
Yeah, and then it's soldered, and it's polished. A lot of polishing going on, unless you're doing the patina. That's a different technique. You know, one of the things I had to learn as quickly as possible is that the last thing that you do on a mobile is create this loop, which creates the balance point. If you get that loop offset incorrectly, the mobile doesn't work.
You use the word loop. Fill me in on that.
If you think of a pickup point on a rod where the next rod is going to come in and attach to the previous one, you create a loop in the rod. And it has to be at a certain location on the rod in order to create the correct balance that you're looking for.
Gotcha.
So if you make that loop in the wrong location, everything you've done prior to that is shot. You have to throw that piece away. Mm. You have to build something new.
How often does that happen?
Not nearly as much as anymore. I did have a big pile of them for a while.
Yeah.
But then also you learn, one thing we used to joke in woodworking is that you're going to make mistakes, and the professionals know how to correct those mistakes quickly. Because they're going to happen.
Yeah.
But you need to learn how to fix that.
And we're talking about 4-5 level copper mobiles to 20-30 different levels and pieces that can range in the thousands of dollars.
Yeah. My smallest piece that I do is a 7-leaf. And the largest piece I've done is, I think, 120 leaves, which is, you know, you have a spiral effect that's like this vortex that happens. And you go from a leaf that might be 2 inches across to a leaf at the final that might be 12 inches across. And it's 7-8 feet tall.
Wow.
You know, and they go into giant atriums and that sort of stuff. It's really pretty fun to do.
One big aspect of your work, it's made in the USA. And it's funny to me that here in the States, that slogan seems to... Today, in 2014, sometimes it's a great slogan, sometimes people almost look askance, as if, you know, something foreign must be better.
Well, I'll tell you one anecdote, is that I went to the New York International Toy Fair this last year, and I was in a new design group section. There was probably 4 to 6 different companies right around me that all had 1 or 2 little items that they make, and all of them were made in China. And that just blew my mind. The fact that a one-person shop or a very small shop could actually have things built in China. I was kind of taken aback by it a little bit. It was the first time doing that show, and I know that, you know, the toy industry is driven by China or Europe, but there's not an awful lot of manufacturing in the United States. So I was really surprised to see all these guys come through. My largest client is a company called Borland, and they have educational stores, stores that cater to educational products for kids. They came in and they placed their opening order, which is 500 kits for their stores. They have 100 stores, so they were doing a trial test for their stores.
And we're talking about mobile kits that Jay developed, and you can make your own mobile, but you provide the parts. Yeah,
that's right. Well, the Japanese came into our booth, and they came in with their crew. They came in probably with 10 people in my little space, and I gave them my demonstration, and they were very pleased. And what they were really pleased with the fact that it was made in the United States. It's on the packaging that it's made in. I've got one that says it's made in Greensboro, North Carolina. And they were really pleased because their sense was that it was a quality product coming from the United States. I suspect that that's going to be the reversal here shortly.
How did this idea of a mobile kit come to you?
I was inundated with people wanting to know how to build a mobile. You know, how do you do that? There are two people that come into my booth. One will come in and say, oh, that's beautiful. How did you build that? And then I'll have the engineer that'll come in, and the engineer will say, that's beautiful. Let me tell you how you built that. That's kind of the running joke, because that's exactly what they do.
Yeah.
They say, okay, well, you mark that out. There's a balance thing. No, it doesn't work like that. It really doesn't. You think it would, but it really doesn't. I started thinking about it a few years ago. How can I design something that someone can put together themselves? There's a whole long process in that, and development, and figuring out how to find the materials and getting it made, and companies that don't do this are willing to step out of their comfort zone to try something new.
Are there lots of variations, or is it a standard, this particular mobile must be put together in order to work?
There's no must in it. Not at all. That's the great part about it, is that all the rods are different length, all the shapes, different shapes. You know, it's funny. The proudest thing that I've done so far with all the mobiles I've built, and I consider them to be unique designs. They're not derivative of Alexander Calder's work. You don't look at his and say, well, that's a Calder. The thing I'm most proud of is this little slider clip I designed.
Is that what holds the initial string?
Yeah, it's the funniest thing, because that was the real challenge for me. I needed to find something and the right material that would grasp that rod and allow you to slide that piece along the rod to change the balance point, but retain, hold it in place.
But still be stable. Yeah.
So you can build this thing, and every time you build it, it's going to be different. You can take it apart and build something new.
You had to have that part in order to make it for something that a child could make.
That was the hinge pin.
Yeah.
If I didn't have that, there was no way. I mean, I could make them prefixed.
Sure.
And I could make them that you could interchange them, you know, one rod to another rod. But in order to make it interesting, in my opinion, is that you need to be able to change the configuration and also the balance point.
So that the ever-challenging loop, which is fixed in your product,
yep,
is adjustable with this.
Is adjustable in that.
Perfect.
It was very, very cool.
Owner, designer, and builder of J.F. Jones Mobiles, Jay Jones. His handcrafted copper mobiles are carried in more than 150 galleries, shops, and museums, including MoMA, the Smithsonian, Guggenheim, and National Gallery. You'll find Jay's mobile kits at Scuppernog's Books and Toys & Co. in Greensboro. If you surf on over to WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend, you'll find links to images of his work, how to build a mobile videos, and more. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and next, we're going to leave you hanging for just a moment, but we'll be back before you know it with the only cure for grief, the sun that drives winter from the human face, and the best medicine. That's right, you guessed it, laughter. And we'll have an extra dose with three hilarious idiot box comics, Eric Trundy, Steve Lesser, and Jordan Fisher, next, after this break, just about 60 seconds from now. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Last month, the Idiot Box Comedy Club in Greensboro presented the Ultimate Comic Challenge Finals. The Carolina Theater was packed with close to 1,000 laughter-seeking audience members, and they got what they paid for big time, with this year's winner, Alex Stone, absolutely slaying them. Past UCC winners have gone on to open for some of the most critically acclaimed comedians in the country, including Mike Epps and Doug Stanhope. Former Comic Challenge winners Eric Trundy and Jordan Fisher, along with Idiot Box founder, comedian Steve Lesser, dropped by recently to remind us that while the Comic Challenge is a wonderful annual event, you'll find outstanding stand-up comics, improv artists, workshops, and comedy classes going on just about every day of the week, right in the heart of downtown Greensboro. That whole aspect of comedy, the timing of it, is so crucial, and to have to filter in waiting for that delay because you don't want to step on the laughter, right? And that kills the whole momentum.
Well, this is one of the things that took me a long time to figure out is that stand-up I used to think was a monologue. I thought it was somebody that got up there and did their act and that was it. And it took me a while to realize that it's a dialogue. And I actually realized that for other forms of performance before I did for stand-up. So why I thought it wasn't the same for stand-up just makes me feel stupid. But nonetheless, it was that dialogue of I say something, you react, and I take that reaction and I modify how I do everything else. So whereas it's a monologue for the first few words, everything else is my reaction to how the crowd is reacting.
That would, I would think, come out in being in different venues, performing different parts of the country. And I mean, you provide a great example early on, at least in your talking about going from a theater in New York to theater in North Carolina. What was that like, and how, what kinds of things did you have to juggle in that sort of transition?
You're right, because but you can even be in Greensboro and then go to Winston-Salem and have a very different experience. So yeah. It doesn't matter whether it's necessarily Northeast versus South, but right. To that point, they are very different audiences, and we all have our material that we know will hit a general audience, and we all have our material which may not, and part of being a good comic is knowing how to adapt as you go.
It's just been fascinating to me is I love everything about comedy, the minutiae of it, just every little thing that goes into it, walking into a room, watching the people as they come in, saying something, and on the fly, having to figure out what comes next. It's like a choose-your-own-adventure thing. And where it's just constantly changes depending on the level of laughter. Did someone just pull back in their seat? Did they sit forward? Are they laughing comfortably? I can notice different types of laughs now. And that's like the most fascinating thing to me.
Although I used to cheat on those choose your own adventure books.
Jordan, talk to me about that. And from your perspective, you talk about that transition from looking down at your feet to finally looking out in the audience and then craving that interaction. How about you in that process?
Yeah, I used to have that same problem because, when I started off, I would kind of deliver to my feet, except for when I knew the punchline that I was about to deliver was coming. And I'd look up at the audience and be like, here's the punchline. And, they'd all laugh or whatever. Like, okay, now we're going to go back down and talk to my feet again. But, it just comes with stage experience and everything. You just get used to looking out at the people and, being comfortable with them. And everybody reads your face. That's a big part of comedy. It's not just the jokes that you're telling, but how you're delivering it, your posture, your body language, your facial expressions and everything like that. And getting used to the laughter and everything. There's plenty of parts of your jokes where you try them out for the first time and you'll get a laugh where you didn't expect to get it at all. Yeah. And that changes your whole set. And sometimes the setup's funnier than the punch. Sometimes you get to the punch and people are like, that was all right, but the setup was the funniest part.
That's when you go back to writing
exactly.
And switch those around.
Yeah.
What is it that gives you that confidence? Like when I'm in the audience, I just feel all like this guy or gal is so confident that I can just sit back and just relax.
I think it's insecurity. I think it's a need for approval and a little bit of attention. And also, I think it's just a matter of expression. Because for me, I can't imagine doing anything other than comedy. And with everything in my life, the only time I'm ever really comfortable is on stage. This is a great quote. It's about a comedian going on stage. He's about to walk on, and he says, in front of 1,200 people, and he says, finally alone at last. And I think that comedy is organic, and that's why when that moment hits, there's no right or wrong answer. It's controlled chaos, and you end up having to trust yourself. So yes, I think it's a lot of insecurity, and for comics, I think all of that insecurity goes away when you have that confidence on stage, that alone time. When you're just inside your own head and free.
Do you have any friends that aren't comics?
It's funny, a lot of my friends that weren't comics have become comics because I started in high school. And a lot of my friends that I was friends with in high school have slowly started doing comedy. So they kind of followed after me and they're like, yeah, I want to do that or whatever. So I know 4 or 5 people that I went to high school with that I graduated with that have started doing comedy since I've done it.
Yeah, there are a lot of people I think that want to do stand-up and they just need a special nudge, So whether it's your friend or some people that are coming to the open mic and they're coming to the open mic to support the local comedians, but they're also going because they kind of would like to dip a toe into comedy. Mm-hmm. And so we can give them a little nudge and help them out there, because it's actually the environment to get involved.
And one of the great things about the open mic at the Idiot Box is new people come and they're immediately welcomed. And that's not like, it's not like that all the time. But one of the things I tell them is just get up as soon as you feel comfortable. And if you watch a show, just about everybody who comes to an open mic, any open mic, if you get on stage, even if it is your first time, you will not be the least funny person in that room. The only thing that's ever been consistent in my life has been comedy. And so I thought it was reserved for gods. I thought they were special, special people. And they are. But then I went to a couple open mics. It's like, it's not that level that I thought it was. It's easier than I thought it was going to be. It's still incredibly difficult and painful at times, but people can do it.
What are some of, I'll throw it open to our round table here, gentlemen, common misconceptions about the comic's life, comedy in general?
That comedians are always happy. I think that's a huge misconception. I think it's one of the saddest groups of people I've ever met. You know, these two guys, probably the exception. They're both really great people, but overwhelmingly happy, which is odd to me. But for the most part, I'm actually very quiet off stage, and people, you know, tell me a joke. I can't. It's not like that. I don't do that.
Yeah.
I don't have jokes, you know, but I'll talk to you. I'd like to talk to you.
I think Eric touched on this, that a lot of the comics are actually introverts. So at a party, if they didn't know anybody, they would be the wallflowers. I think that's kind of surprising.
All the effort that goes into carving out your minutes and honing your craft and getting the audience feedback and then tweaking things. I mean, put it in perspective for us, Eric, in terms of you've got a 6-minute set. I mean, what goes into that?
If you can come up with a good 30 seconds a week, that's lightning pace.
Wow.
The thing about live comedy, I've seen really good comics not do very well. But the thing that I've learned since being in comedy is when you watch that hour special, when you watch that half hour special, that's years worth of work. And so when you come out to a live comedy show and you're expecting that HBO performance, you're not getting that. What you are getting, though, is all of the work that comes to put that HBO performance together. We all write very differently. My style of writing is somewhat lazy. I really only write on stage. I have an idea, and then I'll write it on my whiteboard at my house, and I walk by it 15 times a day, and I obsess about it all day. And then as soon as I go on stage, I just force myself to talk about it. And because I'm afraid of being unfunny, the funny comes out. I have a really hard time writing funny stuff. But when I'm talking, and I have that, the insecurities are eating at me, and I need those hugs from that crowd, it forces me to work really, really hard and really fast. And so that's how I write. But these guys, I know Steve has a very different writing style, which is why we will throw jokes at each other constantly. You know, that's why we like talking comedy. That's the benefit of having comics as friends. I don't have one bit that I've ever done that hasn't been improved by a conversation with another comic.
You all have your different approaches to comedy, but what are some of the common threads that every, comedian or comedienne has to have to really be successful in this field?
So I think no matter how you get to the writing, I think the work that goes into honing it is very similar. So you go out there and you, whether it's Eric spitballing and just talking on stage for the first time, or whether it's going through more careful writing and then presenting that to the audience and that be your first time of presenting that material on stage. Either way, you start with whatever size it is and it gets shrunk down over time. That's you end up finding those things that you should cut out because you're just trying to concentrate the funny. So maybe it was 5 minutes and it boils down to two. And then what happens is you start to find, as you do it more often, you find these other periods, these other things that you can put into it, and it will expand back out.
One of my favorite comedy terms is economy of words. You have to figure out which words you need to paint the picture and take out the words you don't need that just muddy it up. And so finding that perfect balance, that little science to it, is one of the more pretty things you can do, I think.
When the night falls silently, the night falls silently. On forest streams.
Comedians Jordan Fisher, Eric Trundy, and Idiot Box Comedy Club founder, comedian Steve Lesser. Their Ultimate Comic Challenge stand-up comedy competition began back in September with 66 comics and concluded last week with comedian Alex Stone taking first prize. But you can see and hear incredible comedic talent just about every day of the week at the Idiot Box in Greensboro. Open mic night is Thursday. There's stand-up and improv comedy Friday and Saturday nights with weeknight classes and stand-up and improv workshops as well. You'll find links to their complete schedule on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's it for today's show. I hope you had a nice laugh or two or three. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Jorge Clifton. You'll find podcasts, archived episodes, links to all the artists, and more on our website, wfdd.org. And be sure and click on Triad Arts Weekend. And follow us on Twitter, too. We're at Triad Art Speak. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.